This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is another podcast of Worldwide Wave, the international LGBT news and current affairs show, every week on Australia's first LGBT radio station, Joy 94.9.
Surfing the globe, bringing you news, views, and current affairs for the LGBT community, this is the Worldwide Wave.
Yes, it's your weekly fix of international LGBT news and current affairs here on Worldwide Wave. We take you around the globe one country at a time. Now in the studio tonight, Damien's here.
Hello.
Hello, Sarah.
Hello again.
Tom's on the panel.
Hello.
And my name is Matt. Now the Melbourne Queer Film Festival, which is actually Australia's largest queer film festival, has just come to a close last night. Sometimes happy, sometimes uncomfortable, sometimes funny. Each film reveals something about the world in which we live, but from a queer perspective.
So what does queer cinema reveal about the different cultures around the world?
Does queer film influence culture either in the queer community or the mainstream community?
And with queer characters becoming more mainstream on our screens, is there still a place for queer cinema? Tonight it's Lights, Camera and Action on queer film as we speak with an array of filmmakers about the stories that they've brought to life, including Malachi Leopold, director of the documentary Alex and Ali,
Ray Young from the Hong Kong Lesbian and Gay Film Festival,
and Ian Thompson, director of the documentary Out in the Lineup. Here's a taste of what you have coming up tonight.
You know, a city have to have a lesbian and gay film festival because, like, it's important where people get together. There's a sense of a community and a sense of, like, sharing stories.
Hi, I am Tim.
And I'm Ben.
From Hallam, Melbourne.
And you are listening to the Worldwide Wave
on Joy 94.9.
A few messages coming in.
Yeah, first off, thank you, Sam. Sam says all the staff at the Queer Festival were fabulous and very professional.
I agree. The volunteers, fantastic. They always shine and make everybody feel welcome. And, you know, I was there across many sessions, so got to experience that hospitality as well. One in from Jamie. Thanks, Jamie. The Russian guide should explain in Australia we are all mates. Yes, let's put some positive things in this guide. We'll send them an email. And one in from one of our regulars, 317.
It says, queer cinema, like art, can influence change, especially documentaries. If you're a white middle-class male and a little elitist, cinema can allow you outside of your comfort box. I attended the marriage equality film with Alex Greenwich as the AME speaker and was inspired by the relentless activism of all those involved in the film. I think that's a really important message that we can get outside our comfort boxes.
Yeah, I'd say there's still, and we touch on this tonight actually a little bit, but there's still a bias towards films about white gay men, and more and more in the lesbian space as well. But getting that diversity into film, yeah, still more to come.
Taking you around the globe, one country at a time. This is your fun fast facts.
A very, very brief overview of queer cinema. The first queer feature or feature involving queer people is believed to be in 1895, where two men were dancing together.
Now, some queer historians say that this was not perceived by audiences as queer, rather it was interpreted as the men just being fanciful. Others say it was disturbing to viewers as it was against what was considered to be polite and normal male behaviour. Now, you can counter this with the Argentine tango, for example, which was originally danced between two males, and there was nothing sexual about it whatsoever, and there was nothing that audiences viewed that as queer. It was just dance.
The way it was. I think filmmakers certainly pushed the stereotypes further. They moved into the sissy phase in the sort of the 20s and 30s, where the ultra camp gay character appeared, the pansy appeared in a lot of films.
And it was quite easy to do back then because, of course, with silent film, all you had was the visual. So
you wanted all that movement.
That's where all that flamboyance came from. It was, that's all they had to work with, so they milked it.
things turned a bit the other way in the 30s, 40s, with the gay character quite often being the villain and or being used for shock value. So it was the sort of, if you like, the negative side of the stereotype. One of the big changes actually came with the Hays Code. Have you heard about the Hays Code? So this is an American thing that they brought in Hollywood. So the very conservative groups, women's groups and religious groups, wanted to remove what they called was immorality from films. They saw this as a threat. So the creator of the code, Will H. Hays, who put a whole lot of rules in place that would...
And that basically killed the whole LGBTIQ on film for a little while, whilst it was deemed to be immoral and not fit for the screen.
It was more than that. It was anything to do with swearing, anything excessive violence, drug use, and, of course, then sexuality and or what they called sexual perversion.
Perversion.
Homosexuality.
And this is what has made our film rating system that we have today, is the loosening of these codes.
Yes, luckily they watered it down a bit. So, yeah.
Although my uncle used to rate films, and he said 90% are pornos.
Wow.
90% of films that ever come through the rating system.
Well, that's easier to rate, though.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, just put an R plus on it. Yeah, it'll be fine.
And, of course, you heard
maybe that's what happened to Beauty and the Beast.
So that shows you how far things have come.
Hi, I'm Bisi Alimi, and I'm fighting for LGBT rights of people in Nigeria. It's great to know we have friends and supporters like you at Joy 94.9.
We're talking all things queer film tonight and the ability of queer film to tell the stories of our community. Malachi Leopold is the director of the documentary Alex and Ali. It tells a story of an epic love story between an American and an Iranian man in Iran in the 1960s and 70s. So not only do we see how they kept their love a secret in a notoriously homophobic culture, the film then goes on to reunite the couple 35 years later. We spoke to Malachi and asked him how this documentary came about.
At first, we weren't going to make a documentary. My original plan was I was going to kind of like gather his story in written format. Just like we spent about 2 years just emailing back and forth, and I would send him a list of questions, and he would reply back with just pages and pages of stories and anecdotes and, you know, his own insights and experiences. And I was planning on using all that I was gathering to write a screenplay and adapt their story, you know, into a fictional film. And it was during the process of, you know, doing the documenting and the emailing that the idea for them, you know, reuniting again came up. And it was at that point that, you know, things shifted to, you know, we would film their reunion.
Alex and Ali met in the late 60s and early 70s. How did they keep their love hidden in those early years?
Well, I think that in that kind of environment, it would have been much more commonplace to see two men, especially like two young men, you know, hugging or cuddling. I mean, even in public, you know, holding hands. And I mean, that's still common, you know, today in terms of, I mean, there's plenty of places around the world where it's, you know, completely normal to see two men walking down the street and holding hands. You know, my uncle had his own place. So, you know, Ali could visit him and, you know, nobody would think, you know, anything was weird about that or, you know, or unexpected about that.
Now, in May 2012, you went with Alex to Istanbul, where Alex and Ali were reunited for the first time in 35 years. Tell us about that moment.
That was probably one of the most joyous and incredible kind of, it was, I don't know, I mean, it was kind of a pivotal moment. I felt very proud of that moment because of just the effort into, you know, into being able to kind of help make that happen. So it was extremely exciting to see, and it was also just, I mean, for me, you know, personally, it was just exciting to see the actual, you know, person behind all of the stories that my uncle would tell. Like, I felt like I knew him, you know, having spent so much time, you know, with my uncle and with the stories, you know, leading up to that moment, but to actually finally, you know, both see them reunite and then, you know, the chance to meet him and talk to him, you know, face to face was absolutely incredible.
Malachi Leopold, director of the documentary Alex and Ali, explaining his story of how love overcame war, anti-gay laws and time. Coming up, we look at the rise of queer film in Asia. You're on the World Wide Wave.
Hola, mi nombre es Félix de Colombia. You are on World Wide Wave on Joy 94.9.
Messages coming in again. Sam's come back to us. What was the news about Greece that we mentioned? Because his or her partner is Greek. That was from the Russian guidebook.
The cultural guide
cultural
to travel
guide
abroad.
For Russians when they're going overseas. It said that Greeks in all walks of life abundantly sprinkle their speech with curses. Sam, does your partner do that? Very interesting to know. 317, ooh, favourite films, and why did you like them? This, can I say this is just such a hard, hard question?
We've been asking Matt all afternoon.
As the person who's seen probably the most films.
there's too many of them. There's a very sweet one to finish off last night called
Handsome Devil,
which is an Irish film. Out of Iraq, which we did the interview for a few weeks back. Really great documentary. Very well made, very well told. For something a little bit difficult, there was one called 154, which was, gee, I can't remember what country now, but it was dealing with bullying and quite confrontational. There was a weird Aussie one, and a weird in a good way, weird in that, you know how Aussie films, they can be quite different, yet gritty, yet have some humour, yet, you know, sort of everything.
A bit raw?
Bit raw. So it was called Pulse, and that was the centrepiece presentation. Really interesting.
How do you feel at the end? Do you feel a bit unsettled?
Interesting. It was one of those, you know, movies that forces you to switch minds. So, look, really, really good program. Lots of slow movies this year, I think. I don't know. Sometimes I think there's a world mood and everybody was sort of slowing down a bit. So, yeah, I'm sure lots of these will be coming to DVD. And we'll keep track of any specials that come out throughout the year as well.
When Hong Kong transitioned from British to Chinese rule in 1997, there was great concern over what this might mean for the local LGBT community. Retaining LGBT culture was seen as vital. Ray Yung was a lawyer who turned his hand to making queer Asian cinema. He was one of the people responsible for reviving the Hong Kong Lesbian and Gay Film Festival under Chinese rule. Ray talked to us and explained why he felt it was important for an international city like Hong Kong to have a gay and lesbian film festival.
You know, as a city have to have a lesbian and gay film festival because, like, it's important where people get together. There's a sense of a community and a sense of, like, sharing stories. So yeah, I think it's important.
Is it a statement that Hong Kong is a more progressive place than China because it's got a queer active art scene?
Exactly. I think that's exactly one of the reasons as well. And also because, and later on, we actually get some funding, not from the government, but from different charities. And I think that is important because it kind of like makes the whole festival more kind of like prestigious in that sense. And in China, you still can't have a lesbian gay film festival. I mean, there are a couple around in Shanghai and Beijing, but they're very underground. Mm. They're like shown in like embassies or, you know, university lecture room and things like that. And while ours is actually like in the papers and, you know, in a big cinema, we invite international guests.
It's visible.
Very visible. So that's a difference, right? And you know, it is important that to show that, you know, it is a much more progressive society. Yeah.
Where do you think we are at with Asian queer cinema? Are we getting better at telling Asian queer stories?
I think so. I think because, like, in when we first started in 2000, it was really difficult to find any gay Asian stories. I think you have one or two, and, you know, usually a lot of the time they use a lot of, like, eye candies, you know, in order to make it, mm-hmm. you know, more attractive. And now I think it's a lot more diverse, you know, the movies, because you have Thai movies now, Korean movies, and in 2000, I think you only get, like, Japanese and, you know, one or two movies from, you know, Hong Kong or Taiwan, basically. But now there's a lot more Asian countries that are making gay and lesbian movies. And also, I think in the West, also, you have a lot more Asian movies that are made by the local Asian communities. So, you know, and they're also different. Like you will have, like, say, Korean-American, Filipino-American. So there is also that, you know, different ones as well, not all lumped together as before.
Any independent filmmaker will tell you how hard it is to get funding to put a movie together. Do you think it's even harder for queer film or harder for Asian films?
Yeah, I think if you want to make a gay Asian film, you have to multiply all that by another three times, because basically everybody's going to tell you, look, there's no market for gay movies, and there's certainly no market for gay Asian movies, you know. And my challenge is, like, I actually made a gay Asian movie that's set in the West. So you're really, really, like, catered for a very, very small group of people. So all the time, you know, I'm being, like, you know, questioned. You know, people say that, oh, well, why do you want to do that? It's very difficult to make money. It's a very, very small market. But I think the thing is, like, when you want to make movies, it's like there's something that you want to say. And like I said, I just wanted to reflect a certain kind of history, opinion, attitude. I think, you know, it's great that we have, you know, film festivals like here in Melbourne, where it gives us a platform to make that voice, you know. Because, you know, apart from the film festivals, we really don't know whether the movie can really go anywhere, you know. I mean, we're lucky that we have a few distribution deals, but in general, I mean, like, in Europe, like, for example, we have no distributions at all. So I don't know whether the movie will actually find its way to be seen in Europe, you know. So who knows? So, yes, it is always difficult to get money, but maybe that challenge is really why someone wants to do something, I think. So, yeah.
Have you got more to say? Have you got a new project on the way?
Yes, I'm developing a couple of projects, and actually I've moved back to Hong Kong, and because I want to do a movie that is based in Hong Kong in Chinese, which is something that I've never done before. So I talked to my agent about it, and then my agent said, "You want to do another gay story? Really?
There's so many to tell."
Can you do that? And you know, I do interviews all the time, and people always say that, "Do you see yourself? Do you think you would just make gay movies? Do you think you are? Do you just see yourself as a gay filmmaker?" You know.
And how do you answer?
Well, it's just that do you ask Martin Scorsese, do you only make heterosexual movies? Do you really ask? Everybody, you know, like, you just make, you know, heterosexual movies, because, you know, nobody ever asked them that question, because, like, just because I'm gay, that doesn't, I just tell stories about my own experience, and that happens to be gay, you know, but it's just my experience. I can't go and, you know, make a story about something or someone that I really, really do not have a first-hand experience or something to say. So there's so many straight people out there who are making it, so why do I want to do that?
That's Ray Yung there from the Hong Kong Lesbian and Gay Film Festival. Gee, bringing up a lot of different topics there, and I guess particularly for our region, diversity, I guess, is the number one thing there, that for somebody like him, he's trying to make film about his culture, his experiences. And it's just that little bit tougher in the Asian region. Tougher to get support, tougher to get audience support.
I think it would be tough to get support even here as well. I think they've shown, you know, if it's not about white men, it is harder to get into certain film festivals. So
imagine in Asia, where it's not even acceptable in society, so you're kind of battling it all.
There were a couple of Korean films that showed, the director of one of those did actually say that it was very well received in Korea at their film festival. Obviously, South Korea. I don't think it got a showing in North Korea.
The only thing they show in North Korea is stuff they made themselves.
Indeed, propaganda. But I think that diversity is part of a journey. So getting gay films up was the first sort of breakthrough. Then there were more lesbian stories. Now there has been, over recent years, a lot more trans stories. We haven't yet got to terribly many bisexual or intersex stories.
I haven't ever heard of an intersex film, let alone seen one.
There was a documentary
on ABC. They did a whole series.
I lie. I stand corrected. I lie. I correct myself. I did see one that did deal with intersex. I think it was an Argentinian film.
There you go. And look, I think that will come. There will be more stories to be told. Part of it is perhaps that the community itself is not yet ready to tell those stories. So, you know, there is not yet widespread easy acceptance, I would say, for bisexual and intersex people. So, therefore, there's probably not as many people who want to be as visible and tell their story up on the big screen.
I think one of the things we talked about was representation. So does it matter that these films are in the Melbourne Queer Film Festival? So we're not getting people outside of our community. But for people within the community to see those stories, maybe then they go on and make those stories about their own lives, about their own experiences, which aren't the exact ones that were in the film festival. They're all diverse. So this is how we get to diversity.
It is a bit of an interesting thought, actually, because, I mean, it's not just the queer community that has its own film festival. There's the French Film Festival's on right now. The Spanish is coming. You mentioned
Ocean Film Festival.
Ocean Film Festival. Now, I've never heard of that one, but there's interest groups, people who are interested across the spectrum. So these things will always be made. Do they need to be mainstream?
I don't think so. I guess slowly some of them will come mainstream.
It really depends on purpose. So if it's just to entertain, then I guess it doesn't really matter. But if it's to educate, inform, and perhaps change people's views or expose them to a world that isn't their, you know, it's not their bubble, then arguably the more exposure, the better.
I think that there was another film that I saw which was very good called Other People, which was the story of it was a gay writer from New York going home to middle America because his mum was dying of cancer. And it had all the, can I say, usual experiences of death in terms of absolute grief, family, bonding, need, togetherness, all those things that you, if it wasn't a gay character, it could have been a story told anywhere. So I think there's also a part of, maybe it's removing stereotypes in
In that case, did the LGBTI component, what did that bring to the story? Or if anything, or was it just kind of like a by-the-by?
No, it wasn't. It weaved into the storylines, and there was a lot of both humour and angst with that because the family wasn't fully, on his side in terms of his coming out and those sorts of things. So there were some still.
So it was added tension to what was already a very not so happy movie.
No, it wasn't. It had happiness. It's one of those things that in death there is also laughter. You know, you have a wake, you go out and enjoy the experience. So, yeah, we've got more talking queer film from around the world. You're on Worldwide Wave.
Want to hear more? Find out about LGBT life in over 100 countries. Download free podcasts of this show. Subscribe to iTunes or follow us on Twitter. Visit joy.org.au/worldwidewave.
Hi, this is Anastasia from the Sabalt organization, Russia and the Worldwide Wave.
We've had a few messages in response again about the Russian guide to dealing with Greeks and their liberal sprinkling of curses. Sam says, nope, he has a very nice Greek boy who's very thoughtful.
Oh, very nice.
And from 317, talking about film and gay film, saying, having had the privilege of seeing European art house film, sex is depicted in a much more sensual way in queer film than in many Western films, which I think is
I think that's European rather than queer, though. I mean, I'm thinking a lot of French and, you know, even
They have
maybe
just
German
a lot of
films
sex.
Are a bit different. Well, that's true, actually.
I think.
And sometimes there's arrogance from white males that objectivise diverse groups within a sexual fetish. It must be done in a thoughtful and respectful manner. I think that's what I like about going to a film festival where you get a whole lot of very diverse films. You have to come to your own conclusions. They will present something to you, and the films I really like are the ones that put something out there that you have to sort of figure out or try
Got
and
nut
choose.
Out.
Yeah, yeah. So we're talking all things queer film tonight.
Now, surfing culture is often portrayed as a carefree, drug-fueled alternative lifestyle, and you might think that such an environment would be more accepting of difference. Ian Thompson is the Australian director of the documentary Out in the Lineup about the hidden world of gay surfers. The documentary shows that acceptance of gay surfers appears to be going backwards.
Well, I mean, that's certainly the feedback we got from the people we spoke to in the documentary. I think in those sort of earlier days, probably the 60s and the 70s, the whole hippie lifestyle, the pot smoking, the easy living. Surfing essentially is also very territorial and quite elitist. It's all very about who's the best surfer in the pack and where your local surf break is, and you've really got to defend that. And it sort of became very much about to maintain that pecking order, that hierarchy. The best way to put another man down is to use a homophobic slur, you know. So that sort of language became very prevalent in surf culture. You know, if you pull off a big wave, you're called a, you know, faggot or a poofter, that sort of thing. And I think that sort of instance of exclusion of others, and that's something that a lot of the people speak about as well.
You did cover a number of countries. So which countries did you look at?
We started in Australia, in Byron Bay, and we went across to San Diego, where we interviewed the three-time world women's longboard champion, Corey Schumacher, and the Hawaiian big wave surfer, Kiala Kanelli, along with a number of other surfers. And then we found a promising young competitive surfer in Ecuador, which we went across to Ecuador to interview him, Franco Vargas. And we also have picked up a fantastic interview with Dr. Clifton Evers in China, who had written notes for a young surfer. He's an Australian surfer and writer and academic who now teaches in China.
Are there differences in surfing culture within the countries as well?
I think there definitely are. They talk about the axis of mainstream surf cultures sort of being between Australia and America. And although those cultures are very similar, and I think surfing and the marketing of surfing is similar between those two cultures, there were some differences we noticed. We felt that that in America, it seems to be a little more open to women than in Australia. Australia is still very dominated by men. You just have a look at any of the local breaks in Sydney. It's, you know, very rare that you'll see a woman out there. Clifton Evers in China said that there's quite, you know, which is it's starting to develop a little bit in China. The role of the man in Chinese society is very different in Australian society. It's not as patriarchally driven. So there seems to be a lot more openness around that sort of idea of what it is to be a man, and that has an influence also into surfing culture. In South America, it's a curious situation, really, because as open and essentially as the South Americans seem to live life, there seems to also be a sort of a hardline sort of angle against homosexuality in those cultures, sort of driven by that Catholic background to their culture. So what Franco told us is that, you know, in the old days, you know, it was certainly, you know, to come out and be gay, it could cost you your life.
Do you think it is any easier or harder for women to be accepted as lesbians, out lesbians, than gay men?
I can only really base that on the experience that a lot of our protagonists spoke about. I would probably say yes. Fernando Aguirre, the president of the ISA, in his interview says that it seems that women have been more forgiving of each other, more accepting of each other, certainly than within male culture, within surfing. A lot of the women said that initially when they started to surf, there was a lot of misogyny against them in the waves, but there's a duality in that because once a lot of them managed to actually sort of master surfing, they were sort of quite respected by the guys and then protected and looked after by them. That was as a woman, not necessarily as a lesbian. And as one of the protagonists mentions, is of course when she was 16 and she would get the way that verbal abuse she had to put up with was, oh, you dyke, you know, that sort of thing. She said she didn't even know what that meant at the time. But a female surfer who's good in the wave probably still has to put up with a lot of that banter, unfortunately.
That's Ian Thompson from the documentary Out in the Lineup, a good Aussie doco, speaking there about gay and lesbian surfers and showing us that LGBT people are indeed everywhere. You're on World Wide Wave.
Receive LGBT news from around the world throughout the week. Like World Wide Wave on Facebook now.
This is Dede Utomo from Kayana Santara in Surabaya, Indonesia, speaking on World Wide Wave.
Now, we're going to put a little shout-out here, a little cheeky shout-out. If you are listening to this either live or on podcast and you're listening from outside Australia, we'd like to hear from you. because we've got something special coming up. So contact us, worldwidewave@joy.org.au, for any international listeners. We would love to hear from you. A big thank you to our guests tonight. A great variety there. Malachi, the director of Alex and Ali, Ray from the Hong Kong Lesbian and Gay Film Festival, and Ian from the documentary Out in the Lineup. We love your insights. We love what you tell us about the LGBT community around the world.
A big thank you to all of those who have interacted or joined with us on Facebook. That's Lucia, Kun, Marty, Tom, Kate, and a heap more. That's W3Joy on Facebook.
And thanks also to our listeners who've SMS'd in tonight, 317 and Sam and 845. Thanks for your insights and contribution to the show. And thanks to our podcaster, Mark, who will be putting all this together in a fanciful package.
Some film-themed music to take us out. Tom, what do we got?
Can't Stop the Music by The Village People.
We'll catch you next week on World by Wave.
Thanks for listening to another podcast of Worldwide Wave, the show that takes you around the globe one country at a time. Worldwide Wave is the international news and current affairs show on Australia's LGBT radio station, Joy 94.9. You can listen live every Tuesday night from 7 p.m. Eastern Australian time on 94.9 FM in Melbourne or online at joy.org.au. You'll find all of our podcasts at joy.org.au/worldwidewave. Or follow us on Facebook for the latest international LGBT news. Search W3Joy on Facebook now.
Australia's most amazing gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.